From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a federal road fund is about to run dry, and that could leave a $1 billion hole in Michigan's road repair budget.
The federal government is already making plans to scale back payments to states such as Michigan if Congress doesn't figure out a way to replenish this fund.
We look back at the $80 million flop that was Auto World in Flint.
Was it a museum, you know, kind of like the Henry Ford, or was it a theme park like, you know, the other Six Flags around the country? And it really didn't do a very good job of being either of those things.
And how the Ku Klux Klan took root in Michigan in the 1920s.
The Klan in Michigan was as anti-Catholic as it was anti-black.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. 50 years ago today, President Lyndon Johnson signed into law one of the most significant pieces of legislation in U.S. history, the Civil Rights Act. I'm Cynthia Canty. This hour, a look at what it took to get that act passed, what it's meant to Michigan's history, and where we stand 50 years later. But first, there was much anger and disappointment last month when state lawmakers failed to figure out a way to fund badly needed road repairs before leaving for their summer break. And now we're learning there's road funding trouble ahead from Washington. You see, federal gas taxes go into a great big piggy bank. It's called the Highway Trust Fund. That money is handed out to states in the form of road construction payments. Michigan gets more than $1 billion a year from this federal trust fund. But that could come to a screeching halt before the summer is out. MLive's Jonathan Osting joins us now to explain why. Jonathan, what's up with Uncle Sam's Highway Trust Fund?
Well, it's running on fumes. It's potentially going to actually be completely depleted by the end of August or September, which means that the federal government is already making plans to scale back payments to states such as Michigan if Congress doesn't figure out a way to replenish this fund. There's certainly debates going on right now, but so far no action in Congress.
Why is the Highway Trust Fund running on fumes?
Well, it's, you know, a similar situation as we're seeing here in Michigan with our road funding issue. It's primarily funded by gas taxes, and gas taxes are shrinking. You know, collections are shrinking because people are driving more fuel-efficient vehicles. Some younger people are simply choosing not to have cars at all and use public transportation. It's the debate in D.C. actually really closely mirrors the one we're having here in Lansing. A lot of the same problems and a lot of the same potential solutions being discussed.
Boy, if this is not a case of classic cause and effect, here we are, we're doing the right thing. We're carpooling. We're getting, you know, hybrids. We're trying to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And look what happens. There's the effect of less money available because of fewer tax dollars being collected at the pump. And it seems that it would take some speedy action by Congress to figure out how to get more money into this trust fund. And speedy action in Congress, I think we've all seen, doesn't exactly go hand in hand.
Yeah, that's very true. There are a couple sort of short-term plans that would replenish the trust fund enough to last through the end of the year so that they can continue talks into the future, which, again, sounds familiar to some past debates in Congress.
It certainly does.
But as of yet, the long-term funding plans seem to be really up in the air.
So this seems to me could not have come at a worse time for Michigan. We have the roads all beat to heck by the long winter. We got state lawmakers who could not agree on road funding, and now we could lose $1 billion in federal money.
Yeah, that's right. That $1 billion is about a third of the total Michigan spends each year on roads and bridges, so it's a huge piece of the pie. The Michigan Department of Transportation actually says that it probably won't affect us this year. The state has enough money to go forward with projects planned for this summer, but if the stalemate continues in D.C. into next year, it could seriously jeopardize some of the larger planned projects, and MDOT would be forced to focus on, you know, reactive maintenance, fixing problems, major problems when they happen, rather than proactively repairing roads at a cheaper cost.
Jonathan, what comes next?
Well, that's a good question. The president and his administration are putting a lot of pressure on Congress and, you know, putting out the message to the public about what could happen. The president said yesterday that 700,000 jobs could be jeopardized if we lose this federal road funding, you know, probably construction jobs and ancillary jobs and things of that nature. So the most likely scenario, like I said earlier, is sort of a short-term fix. Dave Camp, representative from Michigan, is working on what he's calling a bicameral and bipartisan short-term solution that would at least give enough money for the trust fund to operate through the end of the year, and talks will continue.
MLive's Capital reporter Jonathan Osting. Thanks for the bad news, Jonathan.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
All right. Thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you own an alternative fuel vehicle, making that big drive down I-75 from Michigan to Florida would pose a pretty big challenge. Where to find the biofuel you need to keep going? That challenge has now been swept aside thanks to the I-75 Green Corridor Project. They're putting the final touches on what's turned into the world's longest biofuels corridor. And here to tell us more is the Deputy Director of the Michigan Energy Office, Robert Jackson. Thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
Just tell us exactly, when we say I-75 Green Corridor, what does that mean? What does it consist of?
It consists of a series of fueling stations, biodiesel as well as ethanol, that reaches from Sault Ste. Marie down to the tip of Florida.
And how frequent are these stations?
Within the states that are participating, there are fairly frequent. I can't give you the exact mileage in terms of where they're located, but there's about 36 E85 stations and nine of the biodiesel stations that are along the corridor. However, those are just those stations that are participating. We know that in Michigan, in terms of the availability of B20 fuel, that there's about 58 stations that are providing that fuel stock, and we know that there are over 280 stations that provide the E85.
So it sounds like it's very safe to say.
It's greater than what it actually is.
All right. So if you need E85 or B20 to get your alternative fuel vehicle down from Michigan to Florida, you will be able to find the places to fuel up.
Oh, absolutely.
I have to imagine, Robert, this means a lot on many levels. Clearly, the more places you can get the biofuel and your E85, then the more comfortable people will be buying flex fuel vehicles.
That's our hope. Our hope that is by the availability of this fuel along the corridor, that a person could, you know, say driving from Sault Ste. Marie down to Miami, Florida, that they would be able to take advantage of it, and they would have that security that there would be this cheap, clean source of fuel that would be available to them, and that they would feel more comfortable buying the vehicle.
And certainly,
you are seeing more flex fuel vehicles that are on the roadway now.
That's true. And I can imagine that the number crunchers have been trying to figure out how much CO2 emissions been avoided by people being able to use their flex fuel vehicles.
Oh, absolutely. We know that the fuel is a much, much more environmentally friendlier than your traditional petroleum.
Now, are there more green corridors in the works for other highways?
This is pretty much the test case. I would imagine that if the project has started since 2009, so it's been in 5 years in the making, but I would imagine that if this works, then there will be corridors along 94 in other parts of the country.
Robert Jackson is the Deputy Director of the Michigan Energy Office, telling us about the Michigan-Florida I-75 Green Corridor with very practical solution for biofuel travel. Thank you for speaking with us today, Robert.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
It was 30 years ago, July 4th, 1984, when the doors to Auto World in Flint opened. What was it, you ask? An indoor theme park located in the heart of Flint. The theme, as you've probably guessed, was autos. Big investors came on board, including Six Flags and the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. There were so many hopes resting on Auto World, and they all landed with a big thud when Auto World closed just 3 years later. Bill Shea is an editor and writer for Crain's Detroit Business. Who first floated the idea of, hey, let's build an indoor theme park about autos in Flint?
Well, from all my research, there was a number of people. Some of the car folks were involved, the business community within Flint. A number of people were looking for something, for anything to, give that city and that region a shot in the arm. It had the nation's top unemployment and, the crime rates and things like that were just absolutely terrible. I mean, its reputation at that point rivaled Detroit's for just, all the various bad metrics out there. So there was just a universe of people coming together trying to think of something, and eventually the idea was hatched to capitalize in the city's deep automotive history.
And it wasn't a museum. It really was a theme park.
Well, that was one of the problems with it, and it emerged in later years that a lot of people had expressed privately these same concerns, was that it couldn't quite decide what it was. Was it a museum? It looked kind of like the Henry Ford, or was it a theme park like, the other Six Flags around the country? And it really didn't do a very good job of being either of those things.
And I think, in fact, I remember, I've lived here my whole life. I remembered when that opened, and I have to admit, I thought to myself, I could not be less interested in some indoor theme park about cars. We never made the trip to Flint. I guess I was not alone.
Yeah, I think a lot of people had the same thought in the mid-1980s, and, it's not like this was in Orlando or San Diego. This was in Flint, Michigan, in the dead heat of summer, at any time when the automakers were struggling. So it just, looking back all these years later, it looks like, what were they thinking? But at the time, they were desperate. I thought, well, heck, we've got this deep history, and people are willing to put up money, and everybody loves cars, so why not give it a whirl?
$80 million, wasn't it, that got poured into Auto World?
Exactly, yeah. The Mott Foundation spent over $30 million itself, and it covered a lot of the city's investments, and it's just been one of the biggest boondoggles in Michigan history.
Bill Shea with Crain's Detroit Business. Bill, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, thinking about what a big flop Auto World was, our attention was piqued by a piece in dbusiness.com by auto reporter Paul Eisenstein of the Detroit Bureau. He explores an intriguing question. Why are auto museums and auto parks so much more popular in Europe? Well, here in Michigan, the historic home of the automobile, it's kind of a tough sell to get crowds to an auto museum. Paul Eisenstein joins us now. Welcome.
Hey, good to be with you.
Your piece in dbusiness.com takes us all around Europe where these some eye-popping auto museums and parks. Take us through them. The biggest and the best of them would be?
Well, probably the biggest, and certainly the one to get the biggest attendance, is Auto World over in Wolfsburg, which is the headquarters of Volkswagen AG. And it is more than just a museum. It is a It's as close as you get in the automotive world to having something sort of like Disney World. It's an amusement park, a theme park, that literally draws millions of people every year up to this sort of far corner of Germany. Another reason why it may be that they get such a good turnout is that Europeans, for all that we talk about Americans being a car culture, Europeans seem to have such a deep bond with their vehicles. They're more seemingly more interested in the mechanicals and what have you. And they have a tendency to be drawn to automotive exhibits, museums, parks, and everything at a much greater rate than Americans are.
And so when you talk about this VW Autostadt, Auto World, how many people might come in a given year?
Oh, I haven't looked at their latest numbers, but it is several million people a year on average. It's at one point, it was something like the second or third largest theme park in all of Europe.
That's amazing. And BMW in Munich wanted its presence known. What are they doing there?
They're not quite as much of a theme park, but they have set up one really amazing complex right near their corporate headquarters in Munich. And they have entertainment space. They have a number of restaurants, and they have great exhibits showing all sorts of stuff going back to their days when they were producing airplane engines. The root, by the way, for those who don't know, of the propeller or spinner logo you have on every BMW vehicle. So that one is another major and very popular center, both locally but from people all over the world.
And yet, you know, we think about it, and here in Southeast Michigan, as we just heard from Bill Shea, Auto World was a monstrous flop. The Chrysler Museum in Auburn Hills, which was a lovely little museum, that isn't open anymore. GM really doesn't have anything. And Ford has the Henry Ford, but that's not car-centric. You're going to go see clothing and washing machines and kitchens and all kinds of things at that museum. Why is it that we are just not able to support this?
That's an interesting question. I wish I could give you a simple answer as to why we haven't been. Now, maybe we look at something that did work, which is the Henry Ford Museum. You know, if you look at that, it's really, really popular. It has had to depend on some financial support from the family and from the company itself, though it's broadened out quite a bit. In fact, its automotive exhibit was almost a secondary part of the of both the Henry Ford Museum and the Greenfield Village next to it for many, many years. They expanded that about 15 years or so ago and have updated it again just recently. And in the process, they seem to have made it more important. But there are so many other things. So they do appeal to people who like locomotives and airplanes,
right,
washing machines. So maybe that's the key. Maybe Americans are more interested in a broader subject than they are in just going to automobiles.
Do you think one might make a case for the Woodward Dream Cruise being kind of our version maybe of a moving car museum? Because my word, it draws from people from all over the world.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because in many ways you're right. If you look back to how the Woodward Dream Cruise came about, the original plan, the original event that it came out of, was a small, traditional park 'em on the greens car show, classic car show, muscle car show down in Ferndale. And some of the organizers said, you know, that's not really fun. These cars are designed to drive. Wouldn't it be great to see everybody's GTO and 64 Mustang driving? And so they tried it, and it caught on big time. Now, there are other exhibits that seem to do very well. You go out to California, the Pebble Beach Concours and all the related events draw tens, even hundreds of thousands of people. Then again, these are one or two weekend events, so would a dream cruise work if it was every weekend for the entire year? Probably not.
Well, people, they unofficially keep it lasting all summer, but we know that.
True.
But I kind of wondered if we just maybe see cars differently in Michigan than, say, Germany, as you were describing, because it's so intrinsic to our history and culture that it's kind of like, well, big deal.
Yeah, that does seem to be part of the issue. We call ourselves a nation on wheels, and we talk about our love affair with the car, but it doesn't seem to translate into people actually going into museums and doing things. If you look at car shows that we have, you know, seemingly every weekend over the course of the summer, it tends to be very often the same people over and over again that go to those. And here's the more worrisome thing about the U.S. is that the people who seem to really relish cars, who do support what programs there are, whether it's the smaller museums or what have you, tend to be older. We're finding that more and more young people are, well, I guess they're falling out of love with the automobile. They seem to be more interested in their smartphones and their tablets. And if they do love cars, it's because, you know, many cases they have smartphones and tablets, and they can drive them using Bluetooth or because of all the technology, like Ford Sync. There seems to be more focus on technology than on the car right now.
Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the Detroit Bureau, and his piece on auto museums in Europe can be found at dbusiness.com. Paul, thanks for talking with us today.
Great to be with you.
It was a sunny, beautiful 4th of July in Jackson. There were bands, a stunt walker on the wing of a plane, a lot of vendors selling food, and of course there were fireworks. And there was a 2-mile-long procession of marchers decked out in their white robes and hoods. 100,000 people turned out that 4th of July 1924 for a huge Ku Klux Klan rally. And this was Jackson, Michigan, not Jackson, Mississippi. With the 90th anniversary of this huge rally coming up, let's look at the history of the Ku Klux Klan in Michigan as we welcome Joellen Vineyard, professor of history at Eastern Michigan University. Welcome, Joellen.
Thank you for having me.
We so easily think of the Klan as being the most active in the South, but turns out the KKK had quite a heyday in Michigan from, what, around 1923 till about 1925?
Right, that's right.
What brought them to Michigan?
Well, this is a second Klan. It's a new reborn Klan, started in Georgia in 1915, and then two recruiters took over to gain members, and they came to Michigan, the first of them in 1921, to identify potential sources of support for the Klan. And it spread through the state like wildfire.
Why did that spread so quickly? Why did Michiganders embrace the Klan?
Michigan at that time was going through tremendous changes. It was perhaps one of the most volatile states in the nation. Because of the auto industry, because of the many people moving in to work in the factories or allied jobs, and it had brought a whole new population, and at the same time, new types of work, new residences, and the farm people found themselves being outnumbered increasingly in terms of politics, the economy, and every other way. So it was fertile ground for the Klan. It really was.
And when you think of, as you talked about, an influx of people, especially coming for the auto plant work, you're looking at Southerners, you're looking at white Southerners and black Southerners.
Right. And you're looking also at the new immigrants, some of whom had settled first on the East Coast and now came to Michigan for the auto jobs. And most of these newcomers that were immigrant in background were Catholic.
And I know I grew up right near the shrine, National Shrine of the Little Flower in Royal Oak, often went there. Anyone who's driven along Woodward has seen that huge limestone cross right there at Woodward and 12 Mile, built in 1936. And I always knew growing up it was built that way because the Klan had burned a cross on the Shrine of the Little Flower's lawn when that church first opened in 1926. And I'd always heard that that big stone cross was built that way to make something that the KKK could not burn down. So why did the Klan broaden its scope to include Catholics and non-Protestants?
Well, at this time, one of the driving forces behind the Klan was a desire to keep America safe for Americans. And they saw these new coming Catholic immigrants as a threat to democracy. They particularly did not like Catholic schools. And one of the issues in Michigan from about 1918 on had been a ballot effort to do away, in effect, with parochial schools. So this was one of their big concerns. The Klan in Michigan was as anti-Catholic as it was anti-black, anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish, and anti-black. So they also are reacting not only to these immigrants, but to prohibition, because this is the time Michigan went dry before the rest of the United States. Prohibition came here in 1918, and the Klan took it upon themselves to try to uphold the prohibition law, and to them, they saw these foreigners as breaking the law because they drank, continued to drink. Not that everybody else didn't, too, but they saw them as a real threat to American values, democracy, the Protestant way of life that they felt America was based on.
So that there was fertile ground. That's fascinating. Yeah. If you've just joined us, we're looking at the history of the Ku Klux Klan in Michigan. There was quite a burst of activity from about 1923 till about 1925. And we're speaking with Joellen Vineyard, who's a professor of history at Eastern Michigan University. Can you tell us more, Joellen, about that big, big 4th of July rally 90 years ago in Jackson? Can you describe it for us?
It was, as you said, a very large rally, about 100,000 people came, an estimated 100,000 people, to a farm that the Klan rented outside of Jackson. It was a 750-acre farm. and they were there for 2 days and held this rally, and they had speakers, including Dr. Hiram Wesley, the Imperial Wizard of the Klan, Wesley Evans, and they had, you know, speakers and ministers and politicians of all sorts talking to them. They sang songs. They had religious services. It was a major event. This was not all that uncommon. Other places around Michigan had had rallies. This just happened to be an especially large one.
And for the people there, really no sense of shame, right? I mean, I think I read somewhere where Coca-Cola had its, you know, truck up saying, you know, almost like official soft drink sponsor.
Right. The Klan members felt no need for shame. They felt that they were the ones who were protecting America. And they there was an anti-masking law passed in Michigan in 1923, which was often violated, but it had said that you could not parade wearing masks, namely the hood of the Klan uniform. And sometimes they continued to do that, wearing their masks and defy the law. But other times they didn't care because they felt they were the Americans after all. Mm-hmm. They were good, solid citizens, and they wanted, you know, people to see how proud they were of that.
Why and when did the steam go out of the Klan's popularity in Michigan?
Well, it started to wane after the election of 1924. There had been a major push in that election to pass the amendment again, which had failed in 1920, to pass the amendment that would require all children to attend public schools from the age of 7 through 16 or 8th grade graduation. And that failed again. So that was one factor. But in the meantime, there had been some scandals that were brewing, national scandals within the Klan, local scandals with the funds being mismanaged, and people were beginning to feel they'd been betrayed by some of their own. Mm. And the other thing, you can only sustain this kind of fervor for so long. It was a high-pitched activity for, you know, a year or two there, where they were going to rallies all the time. They were marching, burning crosses on hills, and it takes a lot of time, a lot of effort. And by the mid-20s, Michigan is having, the agricultural sector is having economic trouble. And so they've got to tend to other issues. The auto industry underneath the surface is also having trouble. It didn't become apparent until almost 1929.
Okay. So we weren't in the recession or in the Great Depression yet, but things were trending downward.
Things were dicey. Right?
Okay.
And there's always that chance in any place when, you know, you have the chance of great wealth, great riches, but the flip side of that is not so good. The flip side is you can go broke.
Mm. Joellen, do you think this is a part of history that kind of should be tucked away on the back shelf of Michigan's closet, or do we need to really study this because this part of our history offers lessons to us in 2014?
Right. We really do need to study it, and we need to understand who the Klansmen were, because at the time, even in the 20s, some of the progressive reform Republicans were embarrassed by the Klansmen. They said, this is a fringe group. These are people who don't represent the party or other Michigan residents. Other people later on have called them bigots, but they were none of those things. They were bigots, and they were serious about their issues in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But they were really solid Americans. These are the people next door. These are the people, you know, your Aunt Tilly, and the baker that you get your bread from. These were not unusual people. They're ordinary, everyday residents that we all live among, then and later. These are just people who had decided it was up to them to take a stand. And we have people like that for the rest of the time period. There's a large anti-communist faction in Michigan. And then you move on into the Tea Party.
And it's interesting as I think about what you're describing with, you know, we're going to keep America American. And I'm thinking of the Koran burnings that just happened in Dearborn with groups saying, this is America and this is the way we live. So, you know, you talk about you fail to learn from lessons of the past and you're doomed to repeat them.
Right. And they don't see that those lessons of the past apply now. It's always a different circumstance. History does not really repeat itself, but certain attitudes take hold, and they're very difficult to get rid of. Stereotyping is a feature of everyday life in America.
A really interesting look at the history of the Ku Klux Klan in Michigan with Joellen Vineyard, professor of history at Eastern Michigan University. It was so good to talk with you, Joellen. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for talking with me. It's been a pleasure.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 50 years ago, President Lyndon Johnson signed into law one of the most significant pieces of legislation in American history, the Civil Rights Act.
My fellow citizens, we have come now to a time of testing. We must not fail. Let us close the springs of racial poison. Let us pray for wise and understanding hearts. Let us lay aside irrelevant differences and make our nation whole.
Well, it hit me as I heard those words. We have a lot to live up to. And we wanted to look at what it took to get the Civil Rights Act passed, what it's meant to Michigan's history, and the challenges that lie ahead. So we welcome Leslie Fritz, who is the Deputy Director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. So good to have you with us, Leslie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Boy, those are some words, aren't they?
They really are. They are. We walk in big footsteps.
Indeed. And as I was reviewing what was in the actual act, it was a good reminder, that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 basically outlawed discrimination against African Americans and women. So it's very hard to overstate just how important this act was for our history and for all of us.
It really is the foundational act for so much of the law that we rely on today to make sure that people of all kinds, regardless of their background, regardless of their gender, their ethnicity, their religion, that they have access to equal opportunities in the workplace, in housing, in public accommodation. This really was the first big step. It led to the Voting Rights Act the next year, the Fair Housing Act in 1968, Americans with Disabilities Act a number of years later, and it was the model for a lot of state legislation like R. Elliott Larson's mm-hmm. Civil Rights Act.
And actually, it should have been John Kennedy signing that because he really launched the push for this law with that big civil rights speech he gave in June of 1963, little more than 5 months before he was assassinated. Take us back as far as what was happening in America that kind of marched him right up to the edge and kind of forced him to make this push.
You're right. John Kennedy really began this process, and Lyndon Johnson saw it through to the end. And the early 1960s were a tumultuous time across this country. People remember the images of the fire hoses and the dogs and the protesters and
in
the,
Birmingham,
and
Bull
the
Connor,
violence
yeah.
across the country. And it was not isolated mm-hmm. by the 1963-1964 time period. In 1964 alone, over 30 churches across the South were bombed. Violence was spreading community to community. The assassination of Medgar Evers had occurred. The Freedom Riders heading across the South had been attacked. There was incident after incident that really was growing. It began the decade before. Brown versus Board of Education occurred 10 years prior to the Civil Rights Act. And in that decade, we saw just a steady escalation of peaceful protests generating violent response, and something had to be done.
Also, you had the House and Senate Republicans in 1963 were eyeing black votes, so they came on board with this in a way that gave Kennedy the bipartisan
there
support.
There certainly was a political component to mm-hmm. it, and if you look at the way the vote came down, it was a very bipartisan vote in both the Senate and the House. It really broke down on geographic lines. Over 90% of representatives who sat in or came from states that had seceded or were former slave states voted against this bill. So it really was a geographic breakdown much more than it was a partisan breakdown. But it took somebody like Lyndon Johnson from the South, perceived as not being a liberal, to get it the final step. And there's some question, obviously we'll never know, mm-hmm. but would President Kennedy have been able to take it that final step being a liberal New Englander versus a conservative Southerner? We'll never know that, but certainly Lyndon Johnson's political skills were a critical component.
And when the act became law, July 2nd, 1964, it was right in the middle of what's known commonly now as the Freedom Summer. What was happening then?
Freedom Summer was occurring in Mississippi. It was the effort that was made to recruit volunteers from across the country. And actually, the University of Michigan provided the largest number of volunteers that went to Mississippi that summer to register black voters. The right to vote was decades old at that point, but there were a number of barriers standing in the way of African Americans in the South registering successfully to vote. In Mississippi, you had to pass a number of tests. There was an 850-part code, and you could be asked about any one of the component parts and have to explain it.
And you can be darn sure it certain people were being asked and certain people weren't.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the strategy was that if you brought in outsiders, white outside volunteers, that greater attention would be paid, that the national media would pay attention, that individual citizens and communities across Mississippi would pay attention. So this huge effort was undertaken to bring in volunteers to register voters. And they weren't all that successful looking back in the actual registration process. It took the Voting Rights Act the next year.
Yeah.
But they drew huge attention to the situation, to the circumstances that black voters across the South were facing. And then obviously the murders that occurred in Neshoba County, Mississippi, which were later immortalized in the movie Mississippi Burning, really brought attention to the cause in a very unfortunate way. But the organizers of that effort knew that if violence was the response, which was a reality of day-to-day life in the South at that time, that the violence targeted against northern white volunteers would draw greater attention than violence targeted against southern blacks.
And there was a prominent Michigan name involved with this, with Viola Liuzzo.
Absolutely.
And tell us about her.
She is was a volunteer, and was the only white woman killed during the civil rights struggle. Came down from Michigan, and was a part of that effort. And you know, Michigan has a proud history of being very progressive. We have a number of people who played a very key role both in the activist effort as well as in the legal effort to get the Civil Rights Act passed. So we should be proud of that legacy, and frankly, we should be doing a better job today of living up to it.
Well, in fact, Michigan voters in 1963 approved that new state constitution, and that set up the very first Civil Rights Commission in American history. So why was it, do you think, Michigan was such a pioneer?
I wish I knew the answer to that question, because it might be good for our leaders today to know the answer. We had bipartisan progressive leadership. And you're right. The year before the Civil Rights Act, Michigan actually beat the country to the punch, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
We created the first of its kind Civil Rights Commission, which we just celebrated our 50th anniversary, obviously, and gave that commission, the Constitution gave that commission tremendous power at a time when anti-discrimination efforts were not popular. George Romney was chairman of that convention, went on to be governor, was very outspoken on civil rights issues. Martha Griffiths, who most of us remember as lieutenant governor, was a congresswoman at that time, is largely credited with keeping gender in the Civil Rights Act and opening the doors for women. We had very loud voices at that constitutional convention who demanded that not only did we put the regular statement every constitution have, we believe all men are created equal, but that we take that next step and we create this commission and give it real strength and power to enforce laws. And that's the legacy we try to uphold every day at the department.
If you've just joined us, we're looking at the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 as we talk with Leslie Fritz, who's deputy director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. 50 years later, you kind of touched on this a moment or two ago. How far are we from the promise of this act, do you think?
A long ways, I think. I mean, the reality is the change in the law was a necessary first step. Mm-hmm. You can't achieve anything until the laws are right. But the law can't change people's hearts and people's minds. And the work that we do 50 years later is really more about the hearts and minds than it is about the legal barriers that stand in the way. All of those laws I referred to earlier, including the Michigan laws, the Elliott Larson Persons with Disabilities Civil Rights Act that we have here, create the legal framework for equality. It's up to us to enforce it, and it's up to us to convince and to help people understand why it matters. Why, if you are a person of privilege, and in this society that means a white middle class educated suburbanite, probably. Why are you better off if we are an equal society? And that's the case that we try to make every day. It's an argument you hear being made now in the context of LGBT equality. Why does it matter to me as somebody who is straight whether or not we afford equality to people who are of a different sexual mm-hmm. orientation? Well, the economic realities affect us all. And we all are impacted when our communities are unequal. And making that case and helping people understand what it means to them individually in their neighborhoods, in their workplace, in their communities is the task that remains. And it's a you know, we've been on this 50th anniversary tour for the department, and at every one of the stops, I've said and meant it'd be great if we were on our farewell tour. You know, the job was done. We could close up shop and we could go home. Mm-hmm. But we all know that that's not the world that we live in, and so the work goes on.
You look at the poverty, you look at access to good education, economic opportunities, and then as you said, you know, when will we see LGBT people enshrined with their rights formally acknowledged in the Elliot Larson Act mm-hmm. And on a federal level as well. About the LGBT movement, do you see that tracking somewhat along the same course as the civil rights movement did? Or does it have a different path?
Well, it certainly has a lot of similarities. I mean, anytime you have a group of people who are politically powerless fighting to get into the mix, you certainly see the same elements of the Civil Rights Act of the 60s. So a lot of the circumstances are the same. Obviously, it's a different time. Mm-hmm. We live in a different world now than existed 50 years ago. But it really is at heart the same question. Are we going to treat all people regardless of where they come from, who they look like, what they believe, what religion they practice, the same? Are we going to afford them equal opportunity? And that's the question that rightfully so LGBT individuals in Michigan are asking. And in this day and age, when we know the economic realities and the consequences of discrimination, to know that we live in a state where you can still be fired, you can be denied an apartment or a mortgage, you can be turned away from a restaurant or a hotel because of your perceived sexual orientation, it's hard to make that jive with the Michigan we want to live in and to somehow justify that in today's world. And hopefully our legislative members will catch up and will take action before this year ends. I think the coalition is building for the first time in a long time. I think there's real momentum. And something we've been fighting at the Department of Civil Rights for about 35 years might actually come to pass, and that would be a really good next step for yeah. civil rights in Michigan.
It's amazing to think, truly, for those of us who remember watching the news and watching Bull Connor's fire hoses and dogs attacking those children in Birmingham, because there it was served up by Huntley Brinkley during dinner time with mom and dad. We grew up hearing President Johnson talking. So here's 50 years later, and it makes you wonder if we were having this conversation in another 50 years looking at the 100th anniversary, or our descendants will, Leslie, what kind of conversation we might be having.
Hopefully it'll be a different one than the one we're having today. But the reality is the world we live in is getting more diverse every day, not less. We certainly see it in our communities here in Michigan. States across the United States are seeing it as well. We are a diverse world, and with technology and all of the progress of the last half century, we are an interconnected world. And so learning how to function successfully, how to live, how to work, how to exist in that world is the challenge our children will face and their children will face. And it's certainly not going to become less diverse as the years pass.
We've been observing the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act as we speak with the Deputy Director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. Leslie Fritz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
We've been looking at a lot of history on today's program, the Civil Rights Act, Flint's Auto World, the Ku Klux Klan in Michigan 90 years ago. Love to hear your thoughts on this, either memories or looking ahead. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Candy. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And as always, MichiganRadio.org, and just click the link that says Stateside. When it comes to good even great places to scuba dive. A lot of people immediately think of the waters of the Caribbean or Mexico. A lot of amazing underwater life there and gentle, warm water. But there's a hearty group of scuba divers who point to Michigan as one of the best places to dive. Amber Eisler is a dive instructor at Capital City Scuba in Lansing. Amber, of course, there's the obvious water temperature, but apart from that, what are the differences between diving in the Caribbean and diving in the Great Lakes?
The biggest differences besides water temperature are probably the equipment that you need to dive in the Great Lakes. Those dives that you can wear a real thin wetsuit or even no suit in some Caribbean areas really require a lot of thermal protection in the Great Lakes.
I've gathered that if you're diving in, St. Martin, you're looking at coral, you're looking at fish, but Michigan's got these great shipwrecks, right?
Correct. The shipwrecks that are in the Great Lakes, a lot of them are over 150 years old, and they're really well preserved because of the fresh, cold water. In other locations, you would have a lot of deterioration that happens in the ocean because of the creatures that live in there in the warm water. They don't stay like they do in the Great Lakes.
Give us an idea, Amber. What's it like to dive around one? What does it look like when you come up upon it?
My favorite view on a shipwreck is to actually swim out away from the wreck a little bit at the bow, and then you can actually get that view of what that ship would look like coming at you. They're really phenomenal wrecks. A lot of them look like you could patch up the hole and sail them away still.
What do you think about it as you're swimming around and you're looking at these wrecks and thinking about what was going on? What are your thoughts?
Each wreck has a different story, and so you can kind of look for features on that wreck that you know are special or look for that collision site. There are really unique features on some of the wrecks, like a wreck that we were on 2 weeks ago, the Eber Ward. It has hand carts inside of it that they used to load and unload the ship. So those are really cool to see. Each wreck is, like I said, different depending on what type of wreck it is.
And I would guess this is probably the most perfect time of the year to be doing this.
Yeah, our season's usually from beginning of June to early September. It's been cold this year because of the winter. The waters really haven't warmed up that much from top to bottom, which is a bummer because you don't get that nice warm water on the way back up. But it's definitely prime diving season, and you know, we have a lot of people from our area that go on trips with us several times a year.
Amber Eisler is a dive instructor at Capital City Scuba in Lansing. Amber, thanks for talking with us. Happy diving.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors today are Mercedes Mejia, Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Taylor Mattia, Omar Saladay, Kayla Steinberg, Katie Suha, and Brianna Tinsley. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.